masters of the apocalypse, searching for lost tales in eclipse. Why your dreams are shattered lines, sci-fi whispers lost to time. Hello, recurring listener. This is My Internet Has Stopped Working podcast. We are the Podcasters of the Apocalypse. I have dubbed us a name. And I am Justin, steaming pile of compost, Marquis. We're going to go counterclockwise.
And I am Brit Harmo Sapiens.
I didn't think of a nickname because I was setting up the camera, but I'm Zach Terraformer Petit.
Oh, it's very explicitly on theme.
And our special guest this week, and maybe recurring in the future.
I'm Natalie Gordon, and...
we'll just call you Flash Gordon, then.
Oh, yeah, I'll be the Flash. Fiction.
I've been expecting you. Oh, forgive me, we haven't been formally introduced, have we?
The book for this episode, episode 2... is the 2023 epic tome Terraformers by Annalee Newitz. And to take us through our first contact with this book, I had never heard of it. I believe I did an internet search and it came up as a good science fiction book. So that was my first contact maybe 2 months ago when we decided to start this podcast and I did research on the books themselves.
Same, never heard of it, not familiar with the author, was excited to transition from Mr. Misogynist 1960s dick to something a little bit more fresh, a little bit more new, something that uses more than two pronouns, you know, something a little different. So fresh, fresh perspective.
Yeah, I also hadn't heard anything about it until Justin had it up on the list. I do want to say, though, I am one of those people, I know you're not supposed to judge a book by a cover. But I am sometimes like that, and I do, just right off the bat, really did like the cover when we were looking through all the list of books that we had provided for this podcast.
Natalie, you want to describe the cover?
Yeah, sure. That's, Zach, I'll echo you on that for sure. The cover on this is just spectacular. The writing goes parallel with the book, so you're reading sideways, up and down. And there's a tall tree in the middle, and a divides the cover into two, one side being pristine nature encountering civilization. And I think that that's a perfect description of what happens in this book.
It's beautiful.
And we all have the tour 2023 version, though Natalie and I also listened to the audiobook.
And I was on an ebook.
And Zach read the ebook.
I will say I first encountered this book when Justin yelled at me from across our office, "Hey, do you want to be on a podcast?" And I said, "I guess."
Because she's new and had no choice.
Fair other on. Duties.
So hopefully HR is not listening to this. So the next phase of our game here is to talk about our first impressions of the book artistically. Yes, the cover is nice.
If everything's ready here on the dark side of the moon, play the five tones.
Who wants to kick off with their first impressions of the book?
Well, since it has been made clear since beginning the book that I had a very positive impression of the book, we'll go with positivity. I thought the book was amazing. I really enjoyed the complexity, the detail. It was a world building that I have never experienced before, and I read a lot of science fiction and fantasy. The type of people, the use of even describing body parts, different, there are the people, there are...
Yes, descriptions of body parts, that's a great place.
There are ERT Rangers, there are remotes, mounts, the blessed, there are a lot of different characters, and not just characters with names, but characters as groups. The groupings in this book were very unique, and at times a little hard to keep up with because it was so vastly different from reality and so different from any other world building in high fantasy or fiction I've read in a long time.
This starts off as a nice bit of world building. I like it. It was immersive. There's a map at the beginning of the book that takes you into the setting. I found the world in the map, at least, to be not very well fleshed out. I would imagine a bigger world, if it's an entire planet, that map is very small. So I get it. There's a lot of tech that comes into this. I found that some of that tech was interesting and fascinating and forward-looking, and other parts of it get out of the 21st century, because why is everybody still texting 59,000 years in the future? Like, if texting is the best thing we've got 59,000 years from now, I might just...
But it's mental texting.
I don't even texting. Know what that means, so we're going to hold that for a second.
But I think that's kind of part of the book, right? We have all of these major developments, but what is it that we still hold on to that are these, like, old... That was, like,
love of homo sapiens. Right.
Well, I'm going to continue with my negative train. We are going to talk about the science of it later, and there's a ton of science to unpack in this, including flying meese, or cissus, which...
I don't know the plural.
Moose is a countable noun.
But I also found that the writing in many places was cumbersome, and I found chapters of this book to literally be the worst written shit I have ever read in my life. I was an undergraduate literature major. I have continued to read avidly for 53 years now, and this was some of the worst written crap I've ever seen in my life.
Steaming
piles of compost everywhere. And listening to the audiobook did not make it any better, because the sound effects were painful and tedious, where snarky drones were playing bits of random music that really bugged me. So, positive Natalie, please.
I will counter you on that and say I am an avid audiobook listener, and that is mainly because it takes me a long time to get through written text. I can do a lot better while listening, but there's also specific books that I think are good to listen to. Looking through the text version of this book, I actually think having them both in tandem might be useful, because there's a lot of stuff in the hardcover book, the map, how the text is written. So when someone's sending a text message, it's in italics, whereas that doesn't come through in the audio version. Rather, they just have to say they texted, and then you have to imagine that. But again, thinking if I was immersed in a world, speaking out loud and texting might, you know, the code switching would be more easily there. I liked the intermittent songs, and actually one of my favorite parts of the book had to do with the audio effects, so we'll get into that later. But I will say there were parts of the book where I was just like, oh, this information is unnecessary, and this book probably could have been 150 pages shorter.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. I do want to add one thing too, that I was, while I found it cumbersome, I really appreciated the ubiquitousness of environmental care and concern. Mm-hmm. I thought that the book is written about that. Like, mm-hmm. that's the message of the book. Sorry to steal your thunder.
I'll get to it.
Yeah. But I also found fascinating the personhood of so many different things, and the intentional work of inclusive writing. Mm-hmm. So I think we are at a stage societally where that feels incredibly cumbersome. I think if this book were written 10 years from now, this might feel less painful and tedious, where for me, and I know we had this conversation earlier, that she doesn't always introduce every person's name with their pronouns, mm-hmm. but that was the thing that resonated with me. Every time I heard a name, I was also getting pronouns. I'm like, well, hopefully I was paying attention the first 12 times you gave me the things pronouns. But I found that both liberating and interesting, and that's where I think literature will go. But this is one of the first books that I've read that is really intentionally inclusive. I found it cumbersome in the way she handled that. Sorry, Zach.
No, you're good. I'm definitely on Justin's side on this. I really like the first part of the book with Destry, but once they essentially killed her off at the beginning of part two out of nowhere, it became very hard for me to want to get attached to any other characters, because I was like, does it even matter at the end? I feel like Destry was in the middle maybe of like a character development and just kind of ended. So I was just like, I don't know if I care about any of these other characters. I also just felt like Justin said, there's chapters where I was like, literally nothing happened in this chapter that moved the story along for me. Particularly the whole second part of the book could have easily been condensed. Even looking back into it, I could not tell you what really happened in that second part, because I was so like over it that in the middle of the second part. But yeah, it's there's a lot of clunky, unnecessary writing, I think, is. But the world building, the first part with the whole world building, I loved, and I'll get into some of that later.
The Boreal Forest.
Yeah, and Spider City.
There were parts of this book that were good.
Yeah,
for sure. There were things I really like and appreciated, but for me, the places where it was the worst written text I've ever seen really tanked it.
But if we're done with our first impressions, we're going to talk about player attributes and Lieutenant Commander data analysis, in which Britt will explain the main point of the book, the structure, and the format.
First of all, it was October, a rare month for boys. Full of cold winds, long nights, dark promises. Days get short, the shadows lengthen. The wind mourns in such a way you want to run forever through the fields.
So this book is about the planet Saski, has been transformed from a wasteland into a habitable planet by human involvement. Destry, a member of a team dedicated to continuing the planet's transformation, uncovers a secret city underneath the planet's surface that changes her understanding of the planet and her purpose. The author is Annalee Newitz. So they are an American journalist, editor, author of both fiction and nonfiction, and a podcaster. Newitz was born in 1969 and grew up in Irvine, California. Newitz has used singular they pronouns since 2019. And I felt like that was pertinent because pronouns are a huge part of this book. So this might be actually a part of their journey, you know, how they use pronouns, how pronoun forward the writing is. In 1998, Newitz completed a PhD in English and American Studies from UC Berkeley with a dissertation on images of monsters, psychopaths, and capitalism in 20th century American popular culture.
I would read that.
Whoa.
Way faster than I read this.
Loved that. I added a bonus section, interesting facts. I was interested that Newitz had written nonfiction because the fiction was so engrossing for me, so detailed. I don't often see authors write really engaging nonfiction who also would potentially write really engaging fiction. I don't know. It just doesn't happen as much. People get in their genre and they go for it.
Except for the other greatest science fiction author of all time. Frank Herbert was a journalist.
Oh, I love Frank Herbert. Yes. Okay. So Frank, I mean, writer of Dune. Not everybody is a Frank Herbert. Okay. So they wrote a nonfiction short story in a science. They wrote a 2014 nonfiction science book called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Whoa. LA Times book prize. They also won an award for a short story titled When Robot and Crow Saved St. Louis, which I found really interesting because it was about an autonomous CDC drone monitoring the Metro East population for viral outbreaks. And my spouse is from St. Louis. I was like, what? This person sounds really cool. Lieutenant Commander data analysis, main point of book structure and format.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger. No, Will Robinson. Danger.
This is the world that you know. The world as it was at the end of the 20th century. It exists now only as part of a neural interactive simulation that we call the Matrix.
So I wish I had known this before reading the book because I found it confusing that there were three epochs in this world building. And I did not know that when I started reading it. So when we switched to the second phase of the book, I was like, wait a second, have we fast forward like thousands of years? Yeah, I don't know. And then the last one, they fast forward further. So I wish I had known that. But Newitz was inspired to write The Terraformers after thinking about how fictional stories could carry messages related to present-day environmental crises like climate change. They divided the book into three sections separated by a period of several hundred years each, which they told the stranger was so they could track the entire terraforming process. The terraforming process they describe within the book was heavily influenced by their own experience as a science journalist and by interviews with scientists in the field, which I thought was very apparent. So there was also varying reception to the book. You know, there was a lot of positive critique, but then there was the negative critique about things. So I think the book did have very polarized reception, which is
truly manifested in the 50-50 split in our podcasting group. So we're on point here.
Anybody want to add anything to the structure, story, plot? I felt like it could be. Sorry. Yeah, I ask you and then I'll just... Oh.
This is Natalie's orientation to our office.
I'll
ask you a question and then answer it for you. You're welcome.
Not a real question, then.
That wasn't really a question. It was a segue for me to speak more. I did feel like each of those three sections of the book was effective. It was like a movie, like an episodic little movie an anthology where you've got three separate sort of related stories, but they are completely could stand on their own.
I would have liked it if they were three separate books, actually, yes, though.
Right.
Because then they could have expanded in the first book and then expanded in the other two and make it actually less.
Yeah, because what Britt said about the structure, going back through the whole terraforming process, no. There was 10,000 years before this book started where the Archaeans, we could have had a whole...
There
could have been four books.
There could be, supplemental book of the video game that robot.
Oh yeah, the weird non-engaging video.
The non-engaging video game that is too educational to be engaging.
Really fits
with
our work.
Which is really funny considering what we do.
Yeah. Yes. It was perfect. I was like, ooh yeah. I also want the history and background.
Yeah, for new audience members, that's literally what we do. We make educational courses. We do gamified learning. That's what we do. So that's ironic that
the gamification piece, we're like, ooh, what idea for a class.
It's great, but why does everybody hate it? Which is possibly a great segue into our next section, HAL 9000, in which we explore the heroes and villains of this book. And there are many, many, many characters in the however many thousands of years this book covers.
Hello, HAL, do you read me? Do you read me, HAL?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
I don't even know.
The moose is the real hero.
Oh,
my God.
Okay, why was the whistle? Why was the non-intelligent moose the only smart one in the first book?
No. He's not unintelligent.
I know. He's got a limiter.
Yeah.
Was Whistle a hero?
Yes. Whistle was definitely.
Is he the hero?
He was my favorite.
Here's the problem. We have a singular villain who spans all three books. Ronnie and the other.
Is she a villain? I thought it was Verdant.
Corporations.
Or
Emerald. Verdant.
I really hate the dichotomy between heroes and villains. Mm. A hero cannot be just a hero. They also have to be a villain or an anti-hero, right? So really,
just the category name.
Even in the book, in the second part, and this is probably one of the things I loved most about the book, was that the hero in part one is not a hero in part two.
Yes, because the way Destry's impact on their history, the legacy, is is not received by later peoples the same way it was intended.
Right. Yeah. And then in part three, we also find out the heroes of, the Great Compromise aren't actually heroes at all and are rather just, everyday people. And so I think for this specific book, it's kind of hard to point out heroes and villains. However, maybe the one villain is not...
It's the boring team.
It's the woman from... Emerald.
Oh,
Solyndra.
Solyndra
is for sure a villain.
Change her spots.
Yeah, Ronnie learns and grows, maybe. Solyndra, am I allowed to curse on here?
Yes, please.
She's a bitch. She is just a bitch. When she talks to Chef, I'm like, oh my God, do you even know? Yes. Like, are you aware of anything that goes on? So she's a bitch, and I did not like her at all.
So Solyndra wins the
villain.
Yeah, I brought up Solyndra in later under poorly written passages. So I'll bring Solyndra up later. Very villainous, but almost too clearly a villain, like a trope level villain.
Right. Well, she's just a narcissist.
Yeah.
So
I liked that this book had the villain turned hero trope. Specifically with Misha, who is literally a creature of Verdance, created to be a monitoring device mm-hmm. for Verdance, becomes an ally of the people and Saski and things mm-hmm. like that. Though through weird technological methods, things happen that are gave a lot of ick factor that those could have been in the 50 to 100 pages that could have been gone. But yeah, I couldn't pick particular characters. I was going by groups, so like ERT Rangers, the people, remotes, mounts, the blessed, heroes, and then villains were Verdans, and the controllers, like at the very beginning of the book, the rich-ass colonists, the wealthy colonists who are like sending their little robots to Saski to like check things out.
They weren't robots, they were humans.
They were humanoid. They're William Gibson. Humanoid. Yeah. What were no, they? They're remotes.
Remotes.
Yeah, they're remotes, but they're biological beings.
Yes, biological remotes who are being controlled by controllers.
Kind of like, have you guys all seen Don't Worry, Darling?
No.
That's kind of what I picture. Huh? Anyway, for any listeners who watch Don't Worry, Darling, if we can do like a critique of a sci-fi movie, that would be one to do for sure.
Well, let's add to the list, gladly.
But yeah, the controllers were evil to be sending these humanoid beings to potentially die on this planet.
Oh, absolutely.
If they can't survive, I don't care. I'm just checking out my potential territory I want to buy.
Blah. Yeah. How about the naked mole rats and the worm people and the trains?
The trains.
I know you roll your eyes about the trains, but I loved the trains.
I also trains at that are... point, at that point in the book, I was like,
so naive. Over
it. So I was like, of course, the trains are
talking trains that have feet and that were grown.
I couldn't picture that.
And are both autonomous and self-governing.
I'm so sorry, but has no one seen My Neighbor Totoro?
That's exactly what I was picturing. The cat that was like the...
Oh, yes!
The bus.
Yeah,
there you exactly, go. But it was the a movie or whatever.
The whole section where they're talking about building out the trains, I was like, that's cat bus.
Growing.
I'm glad we both...
I was just I'm glad you that. Brought that up, because I was like, I think I was picturing, you know...
I was picturing like a
Thomas
tree,
the Train. Thomas the Train with just some like ogre feet on him.
No, you know what I was thinking is have anybody read The Dark Tower?
No.
Because Blaine the Mono in The Dark Tower is an autonomous monorail that attempts to kill Roland and his quartet. It's effectively going to riddle them to death. They have to riddle it to save their lives. And if they fail, it's going to ram them into the city that is their destination at 8,000 miles an hour.
I didn't realize that this whole...
There is a thing about
sentient transit thing was.
It's a thing.
It's a deep,
yeah,
nuance. Like Snowpiercer, the train's not sentient, but it is the whole environment. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's
the world. Well, it's
right,
quote unquote, the whole environment.
Is it the Polar Express magic train? Kind of sentient.
Yeah, that's Santa.
Yeah,
that's.
Which
okay.
is real.
I digress.
Which is real.
I digress.
Okay. So heroes are amorphous in this. There's definitely some villains. Okay. Anybody else we want to talk? There's so many. There's the cat moose. There's a million.
The door.
The jaguar.
The door is actually my favorite. I love
the snarky door that's everywhere. It's the door to everything. Yeah.
In a way, it does kind of give Hal vibes.
It does give Hal vibes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. Jaguar and Hal are buds. That's funny, yeah. Actually.
It also gives, oh my gosh, what is the name of that show? It's a British TV series. My brothers love it, and they'd be very upset if they knew I couldn't remember the name of it, where they are lost on a...
Oh, that's called Lost.
Oh,
it's not British.
You can have great British Bake Off.
No!
I'm typing. You're going to hear the deep.
Keyboard effects.
It is...
What happens in it?
So what happens is they're on a ship, and it's a mining ship, and they something goes awry, and eventually they're like 40,000 years into the future, and one of the people on the ship wasn't evacuated or was in, you know, like some sort of cyber sleep thing, and they wake up, and the only people left on the ship are him, the computer who runs everything and has got a personality and is really snarky. And then a character who is kind of like the cruise director of the ship, but he doesn't realize he's dead and that he's a hologram and he has like an H on his head.
I'm gonna.
I don't know what that is, but it kind of sounds like, what's that other space movie?
You narrowed it down.
Three total space movies. Yeah.
With the actress who.
Jesus.
I'm not done. The actress who plays Katniss.
Oh.
What is that called?
Terrible Chris Pratt movie.
Yeah. Red Dwarf.
Passengers.
Passengers. Yeah. Yeah.
No, either
passengers.
Of those. Wow.
Sorry, everyone.
Sorry, everyone.
It's Red Dwarf.
Red Dwarf.
Red Dwarf. Yes. I don't know how I got to Red Dwarf, but the series I'm talking about.
Brothers. Oh, Talking Doors.
Yes. Talking Doors. The character, there are only really a few characters in that whole show, but it's super engaging. And one of the main characters is, you know, the computer runs the doors and moves everything around. Mm-hmm. And there's also a futuristic, like, cat human hybrid that evolved over many thousands of years. It's
just like this book.
Yeah. Okay. I would guess that this Annalie Newitz was into Red Dwarf. We should find a way to ask.
Well, maybe she'll podcast us back.
Next section, Beam Me Up, Scotty. Identify elements of the story based on real science and explain how and why they could work. Include moments, plot points, predictions, etc. that hit a little too close to home and reality or inspire your creativity.
Yeah, well, I told the captain I'd have this analysis done in an hour.
How long would it really take?
An hour?
Oh, you didn't tell him how long it would really take, did you?
Well, of course I did.
Oh, laddie, you've got a lot to learn if you want people to think of you as a miracle worker.
Well, obviously this book is a lot about environmental stuff. And I thought the environmental monitoring, which Destry has the ability to interface with the planet's ecosystem through the sensors, I guess.
Spread like spores.
Yeah. But I was doing a little bit of research for this, and there is some technology that is like using sensors to kind of do like similar thing. Obviously, it's not embedded in humans or anything
yet.
But I just thought that was kind of cool.
Well, and there's a rhizomal network amongst a lot of life forms, like trees, for example. But trees in different parts of a forest are communicating with each other through the ground. So I don't think that's
fungi.
Yes,
but I like that.
Me too. I think beyond just the environmental aspects, I enjoyed the hostile takeover of corporations and how governments are very limited. Mm-hmm. And rather, it's mostly the entire universe, it seems like, is mostly run by corporations. And for a lot of the first part of the book, I was like, wait, how are things working? You know, how is someone able... How did we get here? How did we get from Earth that was being deteriorated to now corporations that are buying planets for seemingly a good cause, right? Creating a new Earth and making sure that it's going to last.
But profiting.
Wildly. And so what happens to all the other guys who don't have money, which we really get into in the second and third part of the books, which I really liked. This is definitely a trope in any work of just the little people rising up and trying to take back power. Mm-hmm. And
Bug's life.
And that it's not necessarily the point of the book, but I like how she addresses, you know, there will always be resistance because someone is always getting hurt. Even if you are an ERT and you think you're doing the best thing ever, you're maybe actually not. And I think Destry comes to terms with that when she finds Spider City. So just, I liked that the push and pull between like, oh, we're creating this new environment, but what's this weird stuff happening in the background? And actually not everything's good. And also getting in with the trains. The trains are just so naive. They're like small children who don't know anything. They're like, the world is so great. I've seen the whole world. It is great. And but it's really not. It's not. And so that learning experience, I think that hits really close to home. It's just like,
so you hit a couple of things. We want to talk about the science.
So yeah, but I mean,
that's the politics.
Political science.
Political science. It's political science. That's not real science.
Aha.
It's not real science. Sorry, poli-sci faculty.
I have science.
Yeah. Well, I was going to hit one Natalie talked about, and that is the actual terraforming.
Right.
Like all of the science they talk about of the terraforming was fascinating. Mm-hmm. There's so much of it. Mm-hmm. It really highlighted the limitations of how we think of our world by imagining all of the variables you need to actually think about and consider. Some of it was very clunkily written, like the Crocodile Rebellion.
Oh, yeah.
But the idea of you got to understand what the prey is doing, what the environment's doing, how it impacts the predators and the prey. And like, I thought that the science that they uncovered about that, I will get my pronouns right, was really solid. That was good science.
I felt like I learned a lot about early geological earth building.
But that's where I think their nonfiction writing, like, kind of.
Science writing. But,
yeah.
Decanting.
And the immortality of those beings.
Yes. And I thought that was really weird and interesting and science-y sounding, but also it was, you know, made up science for this world. Mm-hmm. But the concept of decanting being translated into this, you know, child, you know, this asexual reproductive process was crazy. And the fact that when decanting, you put on limiters on some characters, which then make them subhuman. Mm-hmm. They don't have personhood and things like that. That you would choose, choose to make them a certain way. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah, it makes them blessed. There's all sorts of levels.
Some that are even less than mounts.
They can literally only think of one thing.
Or talk about one topic, but I love how Chef, they all circumlocute around it. They subvert the limiters and still talk about other stuff. I loved that.
So here's another parallel with Newitz and Frank Herbert, is that he has the axolotl tanks. Like, that is how things are created in Herbert's universe, mm-hmm. is they are bred, and I don't know how many of you have read enough of that to know what the axolotl tanks are.
Frank Herbert's lesser known works are actually on our list.
Yes. Some of those would be great. But the axolotl tanks are people.
The tanks are people.
The tanks are people.
They're the decanters women. Are people.
Well, I'm wondering. Newitz has clearly read Herbert. There's a ton of parallels here. Herbert was about environmentalism. That's what he was writing about in Dune, the destruction of, you know, landscapes, terraforming, all of that. She clearly read him. She's my age. Those books were prime reading material in that era. We've still read them. But the axolotl tanks are people. They're women who have been subjugated on Ix to breed things, meat, spice, all sorts of things are coming out of female wombs.
Breeding meat.
And I'm just imagining these decanting tanks are women.
Ooh, that is a very different lens by which I read that.
But it could be, because they make the trains.
That is true.
You could make anything into a person.
Yeah.
And that's something that Misha actually gets into, really important part of the book, is just like, where are the ethics in creating mm-hmm. a new human being? So where is the line drawn of just using something as a tool
mm-hmm.
or giving it personhood?
Yeah, there's multiple levels to this science of personhood. Mm-hmm. The most people things have like nanobots in them that are regenerative and help them stay alive effectively forever, mm-hmm. as far as we can tell. Except
as long as the planet can support their biological needs.
And then lesser beings like Whistle, the moose, don't have those things in them. Mm-hmm. They're still very long-lived, and we didn't explain that in the book. And then I'm assuming the Blessed have even less.
They had a 7-year lifespan. I think that was noted.
Yeah.
It was a
Which
short life.
Coincidentally, it's 4 years in for the androids in Two Androids, Three Before.
It
was 4 years.
Hmm.
Similar lifespan.
Well, as far as decanting, I was picturing the Matrix, you know, those gross pods with all the tubes and they like pop off and there's a lot of ooze.
Yeah.
That's what I was kind of mentally picturing.
It seems cleaner in the book than either of those things we've brought up.
Yes.
But you could definitely take this more dark. Flying moose. Anybody want to talk about flying moose? This gravity mesh thing and everything can fly. And why are we still building train tracks 59,000 years into the future when everything can fly?
I also thought that.
Well, that's what they solve that problem, don't they?
Yeah.
Well,
make autonomous flying trains.
Yeah, but that leads to the entire downfall of the corporation.
Yes, it does.
Because they broke out of an 18th century, 19th century mode of transportation. Finally, 60,000 years from now, they got rid of trains that run on tracks with their little feet.
I love it.
Okay, the big one for me, if we're talking about science, is the wormhole travel. When I first started reading this, I was like, oh my God, wormhole travel, is that possible? So I did a lot of research on Wormhole travel, of course.
You went down a wormhole.
I literally went down that wormhole. Not possible. Maybe 59,000 years from now, but if they're still relying on trains with tracks, sorry, not possible.
They aren't, though.
So here's the biggest problem with wormhole travel. There's so many problems with wormhole travel. The theory of general relativity basically means that, yes, something traveling through a wormhole ages only the amount of time it spends in the wormhole. That's appropriate. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is everything outside of the wormhole ages the appropriate amount of time that happens outside of the wormhole. So if you were traveling 10,000 light years in a wormhole, the world outside, the universe outside, has aged 10,000 years by the time you come out of the wormhole at the other end, nearly instantaneously. Ooh. So there's a really huge problem with that just based on physics. And I looked at new physics and string theory and all of the others, and they all seem to more or less support that. The other issue is wormholes theoretically exist, but they exist only infinitesimally. You cannot keep them open. There's also the event horizon problem. Wormholes are effectively two black holes that are tied together. Mm-hmm. So they have warped the space-time continuum to pull things closer together. If you've ever seen the movie Event Horizon, if you can imagine when something crosses the event horizon of a black hole, it effectively stretches out infinitely and is destroyed. So there's a, including data. Like, so I think even their transmissions of data are a flawed idea when you talk about wormhole travel. So there's a lot of physics around this wormhole idea that don't work. Again, we're 59,000 years into the future, so we could have overcome some of those things. There's also radiation issues related to wormholes. So it gets a super concentration of radiation, so the shielding would need to be huge to make sure that you don't effectively get irradiated and die instantly from the radiation in a wormhole. So, like, that's where
all these problems.
That's where I got lost. Like, when I started to look at the real science, I was like, well, your fundamental concept that ties the universe together doesn't work.
I think that they try to solve that problem by making people live thousands of years.
Not even long enough, given the distances we're talking about.
But who is traveling? I mean, most of this stuff is happening on Earth.
In book three, though, they talk about wormhole travel.
But they talk about it via messaging.
No, I think they actually talk about like buying tickets and getting off world and doing all that.
They do talk about port travel and making sure that the trains can get to the port and things like that. I don't feel like it was an integral or central part of the world building that conceptually adjacent. Like they needed to address people coming to the planet, right? But I guess I didn't think about it that much because I'm not Justin.
I take my job to research the science very seriously.
You know, but I guess I thought about it or explained it when they started talking about wormhole travel and things like that. I just automatically put Star Trek hat on and explained it using sci-fi, you know, realia experiences that I already knew from other worlds. So
what's the fantasy part of this?
But that is, I think that's one of the things that people get when they read a certain genre and have familiarity with a lot of different canon in this genre. You fill in the gaps of your knowledge without even thinking about it.
Oh, those gaps
unless
just create more challenges.
I was going to say, because I definitely didn't even look that much. Okay, wormhole.
The physics of Star Trek space travel.
Well, I was thinking,
oh God.
We're going to go there next.
Wormhole is just a word placeholder for something that
we or technology we don't know.
Right. Or like thinking about Star Wars, like let's just
Wars or Star Trek?
Star Wars, like hyper jumping, right? Mm. So not using wormholes, but doing disappearing.
Just because I have to do this because I'm neurodivergent. The energy requirements to move any piece of mass to the speed of light are infinite. So until you have infinite energy, you cannot travel faster than the speed of light. Because as you approach the speed of light, literally you need an infinite amount of energy to move any amount of matter at the speed of light. Because light has no mass, so it can move at the speed of light.
You're telling me Star Wars is fake.
It's all fake.
You're telling me. I think you should be banned.
All fake. Okay, are we ready? We done with the science piece?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. The word processor of the gods.
wife is Adelina Mabel Warren Hagstrom.
Well, if you're gonna make a wish, wish for some damn money, will you?
Deleted.
We're gonna identify some dramatic and well-written passages that we liked.
I would like to identify an entire chapter. Chapter 19. Children, please turn the page to chapter 19. And you'll be happy to know it's a very short chapter. It's not even two pages. It's Whistle and Midnight. You will not be surprised to hear that my favorite chapter is about Whistle. No, it's not moose sex. It is the final piece. So it's post-battle scene where Whistle receives medical care from Spider City medics as they remove... And in this medical care, they treat Whistle for...
By the way, that was the shortest war I've ever read about in any... What the... Like, that war took, like, a page and a half, and it solved all the problems in the...
Well, it was only a few hours.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because but it was either...
universe-altering war.
Or you stop. But it wasn't universe-altering because no one knows about it.
Because they didn't get the information.
No one knows about it.
Right. But somehow that was enough that this interstellar organization that has
unlimited power. Not the organization. She never tells them.
Right. But they have lasers that they can fire from space and an infinite army of drones. But somehow three flying moose and a cat defeated them in 14 minutes and all the problems.
But it's about investment, right? They didn't want to destroy the investment because they had the plate tectonics they had in backup.
Oh, yes.
Which would destroy
I didn't even start researching whether you can turn on plate tectonics or not in a planet that does not have them.
You can if you put plate tectonics artificially in a planet, theoretically. But it's a sci-fi book.
I will say... You can't have a volcano without plate tectonics. So where did Spider Mountain even come from? And there shouldn't be any eruptions happening if there's no plate tectonics.
Right, because I believe they say that this
So
is
if we're going back to...
Sorry, Italy.
So Whistle and Midnight, okay? So I loved this chapter. They remove the mechanism within Whistle's brain that regulated speech abilities and reduces their and takes their in-ass reading
away. We didn't even talk about in-ass readings.
Yes. I love this part. I love that it changed the dynamic between Destry and Destry's mount. And it ends with this sentence that had me going like, well, hell yeah, Whistle, you go. You know, so the surgery
I'm just
happened.
Gonna say, a moose's antlers are not conducive to flying. They're not aerodynamic.
Yeah, talk to Santa.
Reindeer have aerodynamic antlers. Moose have basically...
wings.
That is very judgmental.
But they're oriented the wrong way.
I pictured Whistle using his horns.
The horns do not flap.
Why not?
This is an imaginative world, Justin. Oh, open
we're
your
now
mind.
In the heavy on the fiction.
Yeah. So,
okay, Bastion.
So... Destry, so it says, I'm sorry, Whistle. Destry had sidled around to stand beside Midnight in his line of sight. Those wormy in-ass readings. Whistle cut her off. You know I'm just as intelligent as I always was, right? The only difference is now you have to listen to me.
That is a nice barrier.
These two pages really changed the dynamic and called into question, like, in the world of this book, in our world, the limitations we place upon people related to their intelligence and their capability is often entirely a matter of access to resources and education. Whistle was created purposefully with an impediment to be a mount, which is just like blew my mind. Do we do this to people? I was trying to think about how this manifests in our world and how much of a betrayal it is for Whistle's closest ally, Chopes, to turn Whistle into this, that decision at the beginning, and did not realize the ramifications of that on Whistle and how that would affect Whistle's life because did not consider Whistle to have any personhood. And Destry chose to have Whistle decanted that way. And I was like, ooh, ouch. But it really changed the dynamic. I thought that was a really cool, cool section. Loved all of that part. And also the trains, some of the trains, of course, but Who wants to go next? What was the best?
Well, I want to expand this a little bit because we also, the next section is the fan humanoid moment.
We walked through the night and made it back to Castle Rock a little past 5 o'clock on Sunday morning, the day before Labor Day. We'd only been gone 2 days. but somehow the town seemed different. Smaller.
I like books that talk about, like, moral quandaries. I love it. And that's why I liked Misha, is because he is a moral quandary walking, because he's designed for this specific person, but the person who raises him, Destry, has an ulterior motive. But we know from other characters in the book that they don't think Destry is all that great, and so then Misha's not all that great, but does he have a point? Yep. Should we create trains that are people, or should we just use them as machines? Or should all machines be people? Should everything be a person? Should this chair be a person? And then the boring fleet, like, they're people. But that means that you're setting someone up to do that thing, which basically means that you're, like, it's just like decanting someone with a limiter. So if you are making everything into a person, you're making them with expectations. And I would say that's true of, like, even us as the only current people identified in our current world. When we have a baby, we put expectations onto them. And so I like Misha's argument of, like, well, you can't just do that and say, like, yeah, they can choose, but you have to think long and hard before you bring a person into this world.
Like a worm.
But just, like, in general, you have to think of the ultimate consequences. Is it better to put the known burden onto a train, or just have a train be a machine? Because you're implanting emotions and thoughts into something that's supposed to be a machine, right? Great issue. And I don't think there's a right answer, but I love that
one. We should have brought an ethicist in today.
Yeah.
My favorite part was page 203 to 204, talking about the great bargain and the in-ass system.
Mm-hmm. Here's something in-ass would be your favorite.
Will you explain what in-ass is for our listeners?
Sure. Intelligence assessments. It's a rating that basically determines how smart something is. And they didn't really give details on how they assess it. There's a lot of jokes around it being called in-ass. So that was fun and entertaining. But it basically, if you fall under a certain level, you are a mount. Or if you fall, I assume, below even that, you are a blessed. If you're above that, you're there. My favorite part was actually the part about talking about how shitty we are as human beings.
Yes, that was funny.
So this is on page 204. It's talking about the great bargain, which is when they decided what would and wouldn't be considered a human. And then Misha let out a laugh, and they all looked at him. Sorry, that's not funny. I was thinking about how Verdance has all of those ads about how Saski is this return to old Earth with the pure H sapiens and perfect Pleistocene ecosystem. And yet nobody wants to be an actual H sapiens, which we all are, by the way, with an unmodified body. Imagine going around with a brain from, I don't know, 50,000 years ago, 60,000, right before the farm revolutions. Your in-ass rating would put you slightly above Mount.
Just found that. Damn it. We're stupid. I'm fairly not a mount. Terrible.
It goes to Natalie's quandary, like, what does intelligence mean? What will intelligence look like 10, 20, 50,000 years from now? We're in the dawn of AI. Anybody who's seen the Steven Spielberg movie, Artificial Intelligence, there's like a jump of 30,000 years there, and basically artificial things have taken over the world. That's the next stage of evolution in that particular science fiction story. So it's very fascinating in this book that there's modified humans in many different ways. We're coming on to the asexual reproduction section soon. There's modified humans in lots of different ways. Lots of different things are considered people. Why are there still biological people? Like, that's one huge question I would ask 59,000 years from now. We are still largely, even though it's such a huge time from now, we're still largely following the same model of human.
They address that.
That they...
In the third part.
There's arcane...
Well, yeah, because they have to... Even machines have to have some sort of flesh, so DNA, and whether that's like plant flesh or human flesh, animal flesh.
Semen.
Yeah, both. But they... I think probably one of my, I don't know if it was very well written, but I just thought it was hilarious about, well, Age Sapiens had these weird categories of people like African, indigenous, and they just thought, oh, indigenous. And that made me laugh really hard. And I think the whole point of Annalie doing that was maybe like a jab to people who do not respect indigenous cultures and indigenous people, that in the future they're like, this is it.
That's the thing.
And so everyone needs to be an indigenous American or just an indigenous person
anywhere on this planet or from another planet.
Yeah, I thought that was funny too.
I thought it was hilarious. Yeah, so, but I think they explained that you at least need like some segment of DNA in order to become a person.
No, my concern is that humans are still the thing, 60,000. Not that anything can be a person, but that effectively the things that are running things
are
human. Yeah, and it's very anthropocentric. Mm-hmm.
I think that's also the point, though, right? Yeah. We give the limiters
to maintain our structure. Very plausible. We've got the next section is poorly written passages.
Wait, did we already do our favorite moments?
Oh, do you still? Oh, sorry.
I still have one.
Oh, I thought you had.
But, the singing please. Of the trains. And
this, oh, that was interesting.
This is because, so I listened to the audio version.
Yeah, that was loud.
And in the book, I kind of read the passage. You can make it up in your head, but in the audiobook version, there was a full surround sound of like,
you want me to play it?
The conversation that was happening. Ooh. And I thought that was my favorite part of the book, because Annalie with her audiobook producer comes back at the very end of the book and plays that song again. And it was just really lovely. So even though that I think the trains are super naive, they do have a lot of experience to give. And so, yeah, I mean, Justin, go ahead.
Was it in the closing or was it in chapter 47?
It's in both.
This is all the noise that the trains have recorded in all of their travels all over the world.
This is Emily Lords. Thank you for listening to The Terraformer.
I love that.
It's interesting.
That is cool.
But so like that whole in the chapter, it was probably like 3 minutes long of listening to music. So you were fully, you know, in the book, it just shows Misha being like, or not Misha, the cat. What's the cat's name? Moose, yeah. Oh, yeah. The cat Moose, who is Whistle's great-grandson. Mm-hmm. Great-grand-cat.
Great-grand.
Or grand. Either grand, whatever.
Grand thing.
And in the book, it's just like, oh, what are you guys doing? The train's like, we're singing. He's like, okay. It's kind of weird. But in the audiobook, you can actually hear it. And it, so, yeah. That was probably one of my favorites.
I had trouble picturing that. I kind of mentally imagined this shared like Gregorian chant moment where like hum.
Same.
Yeah.
They all started to hum together. So that makes so much more sense that it was actual trains. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen the Bjork movie, Dancer in the Dark, no? Mm. It's a musical with Bjork singing, but she's going blind, so she imagines the world around her through musicals. And she works in a factory, and all of the music starts with the ambient noise of factory stuff. Ooh. Part of it takes place at a train. She does this dance song next to a train, on a train, and it's the music comes in. So it's a lot like that.
Yeah, interesting. Maybe Annalie Newitz was into Bjork.
Maybe. It's a great movie if you ever want to see a really tearjerker movie, Dancer in the Dark. Okay, sorry.
Go ahead.
Did you get a favorite moment?
I was going to just say my favorite part, of course, is in the first part because that was my favorite part. But I really like when Destry discovers Spider City. I liked the door. I was like, oh, so it's going to be like these little guys help start this chain reaction. I mean, and they do in a way, but It was
short-lived.
You had it more. You wanted more.
Yeah. Well, I wanted it. Like I said earlier, it would have been nice to have three separate books because I feel like you could do a lot more in each one.
Yeah.
And the war that lasted 45 seconds.
14 seconds. I didn't even have the juice at that point to research what it would take to create a material that would stop lava.
But you considered it.
Well, I sure did. Or hold the weight of an entire lake.
What's funny is those things, the desire to research, if that's even possible, doesn't come into play for me because I am one of those people who truly embodies the whole suspended disbelief when reading this genre. Yeah, I just take it as gospel. I'm like, yeah, they have a material that stops lava. Boom. Authors love me.
It's gotta hit somewhere.
Okay, our next.
The next is page 404, page not found.
Any of you all know what a sundown town is?
Yes, sir, we do.
Well, this is a sundown county. If I had found you pissing in my woods like animals after dark, it would have been my sworn duty to hang every single one of you from them trees.
It's not sundown yet.
WTF, what the fiction. Lost in space, so poorly written passages, things that are too far out there to be believed, even in a work of science fiction or fantasy. Then we're going to save Lovecraft and asexual reproduction for a minute.
Master, sir, I heard Yoda talking about midichlorians. I've been wondering, what are midichlorians?
I have one for...
Go ahead.
So this was just one of several times where I feel pulled out of the story, but it's 60,000 years in the future, 59, whatever, and on a different planet in the galaxy, but they're still using the phrase memes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was driving me insane.
I'm texting.
But it was like, so the passage I have is, that I went back and found was, his outburst became a low circulation meme between zest and sulfur. And that could easily just have been replaced with become a circulation or a low circulation joke. Like, that's all. It was just a word change. But the fact that, and I searched it on my ebook reader, and yeah, they used the word meme like 5 or 6 times. And it drove me insane every time because it's like, we're still using this
antiquated.
This, like, in terms of the history of existence, a tiny part where we use the word
meme. 1 second time. That's honestly the same thing with texting. Like, it's mind communicate. It's mind to mind communicate. It's telepathy. There's a million. You invent a phrase. It's literally not texting unless they are somehow seeing the words show up in their head as text.
Well, I think some of the things you can find, like if you broadcast your text, it can show up on like people's.
But not in their minds.
Maybe.
It wouldn't be a text. It would be some
sort of telepathy. Yeah. There's other words for this that were more creative, more descriptive, more futuristic than text.
Yeah. Well, and the level of, I guess, just using word choice that it's very much currently in use.
Right.
But then choosing to be really creative and come up with an entire new language to describe body parts. Mm-hmm. So I think the level of...
was uneven. The level of creativity was uneven.
Yes.
Because, yeah, you're right. That was very, that's very, you know.
And I went back to
2020.
When I read that sentence, like, did they mean memes? Or did I read that wrong? I, like, had to reread that sentence the first time it appeared. Because, like, is this just, again, one word that means something else? And I'm like, not sure.
Memes are so powerful, they transcend all of human history for the next 60,000 years.
And then she uses memes again with Solyndra.
Yeah.
Solyndra became a meme circulating throughout the galaxy. And I was like, I imagined, I do imagine Solyndra as like a Karen.
Yeah.
But like a blue Karen with 47 nipples or something.
Yeah, something weird. Oh my God. I thought all the Solyndra passages were, she was just too diabolical, too evil. She's like, mwah, ha, 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 and her tower, you know, making very evil decisions that were also very stupid. Like, this person is ruining so many lives but doesn't bother to read a contract more carefully.
But it's because she's a narcissist.
Yes.
And I think that's because when she's having the meeting with
Misha
and the other people from Spider, she's just like, wow, I did such a good job with you until I failed, which, I mean, I guess was my fault, but, like, you're still here, so I guess that's a win, and it must be so hard to be you. You can't sexually reproduce, which we will get into the next section. Right. But then also the excerpt passage of her talking to Chef. Mm. I'm just like...
Mm-hmm.
And
I did like the Chef character.
Yeah. So I just think... I think she's not diabolical because narcissists don't think that they're diabolical. They don't think that they're doing anything wrong.
True. True. There had to be a bad guy.
Yeah.
You know,
quote bad gal.
Bad gal. Bad creature.
Person.
Bad person.
I have a cringy passage. Do you have one?
All sex passages?
No, we're not to sex yet.
We're at love. Crapped, cringy.
We're not at love. We're still at 404. Yeah, so this goes to my. Well, I'm going to talk about the overall assessment, but I like the message of this passage. Like, I think the idea is great. This is page 44 and 45. I think the idea is great, but I think the execution of the writing is so painful sometimes. So Destry was taken aback. Those were shameful words. A ranger who allowed ecosystems to become unsustainable lost their honor and the faith of their community. She glanced at Lucky, wondering whether they regretted asking the H. sapiens for help. The Archean wore an awkward expression that mirrored the other human hominin faces. Nobody wanted to call Long out for his taboo comment. To do so would only make everybody's embarrassment more acute. Rocket raised their sensor bulb again and played a few seconds of sprightly dance music to break the silence.
That's basically what it was.
I think it's obvious that we need to coax the eel back to its old bend. It won't be easy. Gratefully, Lucky nodded. Let's take a closer look at that dam. They zoomed in on the river north of Spider and went deep into a discussion of seasonal flows with Nil and Rocket. She was glad to see that their ERT instincts for problem-solving had dissipated the tension with Long. It's just so clunky and painful and forced, and the dialogue is
bad. I was reading some Goodreads reviews, and a lot of people say, like, how are they 50,000 years in the future and still act like teenagers?
Yes, complaining? That's my end critique of this. Okay. Yes. Absolutely. All right. We dare we go there. This is about to become an X-rated podcast.
Don't you understand? He won't just influence us. He'll devour us and the rest of the human race if he can.
You're so beautiful.
Please, Crawford.
It won't hurt. I promise.
I want to just say that I don't think, you know, if we continue in our human evolution, we will still be some form of human evolution, theoretically, whatever that looks like. I don't think that there will ever be a transition away from us not having a formative experience that we then transition to more like calm, technically more intelligent being later in life than dead. We have to have an awkward phase. We will always have a growing process, right? We will always be some sort of adolescent, foot-in-your-mouth weirdo, theoretically, in every evolutionary process for all beings, whatever they may be. There's a, you know, you're acquiring data. You're teaching a computer. Initially, the computer is going to be clunky. You give it more information. AI. Its processes get more smooth, right? So even... I think that's just the concept of evolution. So you have to have clunky. Now, the writing being clunky and overly, you
snappy.
Know. Yeah. Well, and then, well, that sentence, I thought the part that was silly was then it says, so glad, she was glad to see that their ERT instincts for problem solving had dissipated the tension with Long. Some of the tension, anyway. It's like some person, it's like being narrated. By a soap opera in some parts. It was a little weird. Yes. So that there, I stepped off my soapbox. Back to the sex.
Okay, Lovecraft, which are cringy passages, and asexual reproduction, which are awkwardly racy parts of the book.
If you wish to be warm, Dr. Smith, come into my arms.
I'd rather die.
Go ahead.
This book is not a smut book. There was zero need for any sex scene. I think in the first part, it was okay. Because in any world creation, any person is going to be a sexual being, right? And so they establish that with the moose going off to the bedroom.
And they didn't have to show it.
And they didn't. And
we all knew what happened.
Annalee didn't show it.
We all pictured
it. But then for some reason, in the second and third part, Annalee really needed to talk about how sex happens. And I didn't think it was necessary in the slightest.
You didn't need a bar hand job?
I didn't need a bar hand job.
How about sex between a cat and a robot beaver?
I was listening to it, I was like, this is turning into a smut book, and I don't think Justin wants HR to know that I'm listening to smut on the job.
I think it's fine.
Have
that on.
Yeah, please, listen away. The giant petals.
I said awkward racing parts. Note: petals throbbing. Ha ha ha.
And stamens.
Exclamation point. I think the listeners will figure out. You know, I grabbed my stamen.
Yep.
The petals were throbbing. Ugh.
Yeah, the whole bar scene. I was like. That was gonna be like secondhand embarrassment. I was like, can I just like
sit? Weird voyeuristic sex.
I really don't need
which
to
is very niche. It's this. Even niche in the sex land.
Yeah.
Like, him using his robot settings as a dildo.
It's so
It was so
out of like left
field. Yeah, I was just so surprised. I was like, whoa, because all Annalee really needed to do was come out of that meeting with Solyndra where What's-Her-Face from Spider City is angry because she's like, no, I am a sexual being. I have, because one of the things that Solyndra says is, there is a reason I made you all not have sexual desire. And she's like, I have sexual desire. But that's all it needed to be, was like, and then I went on this date with this droid and we went home together. And that's all that needed to happen. It didn't need to be anything else. And even the stuff with Misha, like the intimate part, I did think that part was nice, but it could have been executed differently. Like, he doesn't want anyone to know, what doesn't want Verdance to know that he's having an emotional.
That part with the meshy stuff was.
Yeah, but you can have that part where they're putting the mesh on and touching, and then it fades to black. I don't need to know anything else that you did.
This is probably not the time or place for this. Can somebody please explain to me what happened? Because there was penetration. There were a lot of nipples.
They were putting on.
I don't really understand what happened.
They were
in that
putting
scene.
On a body condom.
No, that was the mesh.
Yeah.
But there's another sex scene with Misha, and there's parts that I don't understand.
I think that's the point. You're supposed to be a little confused because it's not how
we are.
It was definitely not what I was imagining was going to happen. And then I just didn't.
That was definitely like a skim part.
Yeah, like, what the?
When do we get the end of this? Yeah. Here's the thing about the awkward, racy parts of this book that I appreciated. That it was very creative. The plant.
Sure.
Plant labels for sexual organ stuff. Very bizarre to read. But I did feel like it made things very gender neutral in a way that was unexpected and thus very futuristic. I think that a lot of futuristic books that I've read still use the same
male-female
dichotomies, still use the same, you know, references that are pretty trope. But this, by changing these to plant names, terms, terminology, it made it very gender neutral for me to read, which made even those sex scenes that were very awkward, I was like, wow, this feels very out of my realm. Very hard to picture, which felt very futuristic to me in a way that I've not read in any other books because I can usually picture what's happening.
So are they all sterile?
Yeah, that's why they have decanters.
Right, interesting that reproduction has been completely made non-biological.
Which is why Solyndra thought that you have no sexual desire because you have no ability to reproduce. I'm like, okay.
Wake up.
missionary position only is for child reproduction purposes. No, it's this book also talks about sex for the purpose of enjoyment and engaging in your physicality and things like that. So I know that was cool. It was for actually reading it. That didn't
even yeah. But there was sex between a cat and a train.
There was sex between everything.
the cat and the train part, you know, the train was mostly in its
raccoon body.
However, the most sexy part was when the cat purred up against the train side. I was like, no.
If a cat and a train can have sex,
like being voyeuristic of every
what else
passenger.
Was happening in this world? Like this unleashes a whole area you don't necessarily need to think about.
I rode the bus to work today. Exactly. I was purring up against the bus.
You're bouncing.
You can catch something from that.
Thank you, Spokane Public Transit.
It's like the washing machine.
Ooh. Oh.
Okay, I think we've talked about the asexual reproduction.
Yes.
Enough. So the next part is the end game. So we've got intruder alert, strange and crazy plot twists, deep impact, cultural significance of the work. Where's Bowie? Which was a push for me this time. And the pew-pew scale. Pew! So, intruder alert, strange and crazy plot twists.
Danger, Will Robinson! Danger! No, Will Robinson! Danger!
What the hell happened to Destry?
Yeah, at the end of book one, you're just like, wait, what's going on? Like Britt said earlier, you're like, wait, so this is taking place in the future?
Do we even know how she died? Because I feel like I missed it. But
Misha alludes to it.
Yeah, they mentioned
that she like went a little bit too far on one of their missions, and then
was pew pew.
Yeah, but Misha doesn't want to talk about it because it's traumatic for him, right. And that's why he's having
a lost opportunity to tie that in,
right,
and explain more about
yeah. But I think you're right. I was expecting the second part to be her and Misha.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I would love that story.
Yeah.
I'd love that story.
Yeah, so those were the plot twists for me, it jumped, and there were whole different things happening each time. Again, loosely related.
Yeah. Like, figure out all these new characters every time.
Yeah.
And their pronouns.
Yeah.
Everything else about it.
I thought the fact at the end that Ronnie came back into the picture. Ronnie is the one that worked for Verdance, right? Mm-hmm. So Ronnie kind of didn't seem evil at first, but then ultimately was just very much a creature of Verdance, terrible person. Mm-hmm. And then took down Verdance and put out the secret memo. And mm-hmm. I was like, what?
Yeah.
And I don't think it didn't feel to me like an opportunity for them to repair a wrong. I think they are just vindictive assholes.
It goes back to Greek drama. It was Deus Ex Machina. Like, let's just throw a random thing in there that nobody expects, and that'll solve the problem.
Yes.
Like, you didn't build to it. You didn't earn it. You just threw a solution out there to close the book.
Yeah.
Well, and they just kind of like, oh yeah, she used to be a next thing, and it's when they found out that Spider City had a treaty that they fired her, and it was just like, okay, well, that was anticlimactic.
Yeah.
There was a lot of anticlimactic stuff in this. Like, again, the war that lasts for literally like a page and a half. And they call it a war, but it was like
The Eel River War.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I did think the double entendre of get the eel back into its place was kind of funny. Nobody? Nobody?
Nope.
Get my mind out of the gutter.
Be hard.
Yeah. I already passed that section.
I can't let it go.
I think.
And the eel was alive. So, I mean, that totally was a sex scene. Like the
re-diverting the river?
Yeah, because it was like, and she just slid. Because at the beginning of that chapter, they, in the ERT handbook, it says, the river might never assume something is or is not a person. The river might be a person. And you don't know it. And they allude to the fact that the Eel River, is in fact a person. And so she slid right back in to her old home.
Mm. Yeah, I was getting a lot of connotations. I think Annalise a little kinky.
She's clearly
a little.
A little. Well, I was going to say there's probably going to be some fan fiction off of this book.
Oof. There probably already is. They're working hard on that.
And I just want to say those jumps for me made the drama way less impactful.
Yeah.
I agree.
They broke the narrative. They stopped the drama. They reset it, but often in different ways. And it just killed the momentum.
Yeah.
Those weird, abrupt changes really hurt.
Could that have been fixed if instead of going straight into, you know, part one, Settlers, if it had had a foreword where it's like, this is, you know, set this in, this is a written case study of the terraformation of this world in three epochs.
Right. You know? Or like, this right. is a rapper. This is a history of this, of Saski.
Yes. So you're like, ooh, I'm reading a futuristic, you know, documentary that was written after the terraformation of this planet.
Right.
Something and then like it that. Kind of, then it would seem less abrupt because you know it's coming.
You know what? That I'm 100% convinced that she's a Herbert fan because those little pieces from the ERT handbook at the beginning of each chapter.
Yes.
Herbert does that with the Bene Gesserit.
Yes, with the Bene Gesserit, with the orange.
The OC Bible.
The OC Bible.
Yep. So she's 100% a Herbert fan. You heard it here first.
Are you ready for your moment to shine, Bowie?
Well, we got to do Deep Impact still.
We watched as the bombs shattered the second comet into a million pieces of ice and rock that burned harmlessly in our atmosphere and lit up the sky for an hour.
Okay, Deep Impact. I looked. There's obviously no sequels yet. There's no movies yet. The reviews that I found were mostly positive. I found a fan review that was just, this is trash and I don't need it. So given that it's such a new book and there's no impact, do you guys want to see the movie?
No.
I would if it was three movies.
If it was X-rated.
Any, well, you know.
Or how. Like, actually, I'd watch a TV, a miniseries.
Okay, I can see that.
And you could do each season would be
a different. You could jump, for sure.
And that way she could, or they could, Annalie could come back and be like, okay, this is what happened to Desiree. And like have that be more impactful. But I think I would like to see it as a movie because I want to know how Anna Lee pictures all of these characters.
What the vision is.
Because they're kind of amorphous blobs in my brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the descriptions of them are so wacky sometimes.
Right.
Well, and Hollywood would totally Lord of the Rings this book and turn it into three. Minimum. They love three.
13 movies.
Yeah. You know?
All right.
All right, Apple.
Where's Bowie?
HBO. Where are you?
This is an Amazon series.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I can see that.
Where's Bowie? So we do a section each time where I try and connect whatever we've read to David Bowie. There was an obvious connection into Android's Dream of Electric Sheep, which you missed, but you can listen to the podcast, Natalie. And anyone else should listen to that podcast, now available on some platforms that we haven't decided on yet. For me, the closest I could get to connecting this to Bowie was the 1999 video game Omicron the Nomad Soul. Bowie was, I believe, a producer on that video game. He was a character in the video game, and I'll explain what happens in the video game in a second. But the point of the game was, I think, for Bowie, he released an entire album in the game. So as you adventured through the game, you would find tracks of the album. You could take them back to your domicile and play them to hear the tracks before the album was released. The album is ours. But the gameplay for this game and the thing that reminded me of this book is that to accomplish specific tasks in the game, you had to die and be reincarnated in a different body. So I was thinking of that with the train and the cat body and people able to jump into and out of different bodies in different places. That evoked for me Omicron, the Nomad Soul. A tough, tough connection there, but okay. Pew, pew! We're going to go around on a scale of 1 to 5, and that 5 would effectively be 10 pew-pews for those new listeners and Natalie. So a 1 pew-pew rating is pew-pew. A 2 pew-pew rating is pew-pew-pew-pew. Okay. All the way up to 10
pew-pew
noises.
I'd like to point out something before we pew-pew rate.
Sure.
There was a bar in this book called Meta-pew.
Meta-pew.
The one that they went
to. Really?
Meta-pew. too.
Is that where they...
Is that the game?
As yeah. Yeah, as Moose listened in wonder, Scrubjay added their own voice to the mix. It was the bleeping, meeping, and zigging of the games at Metapew from the first night they went out together. The
game bar, yeah.
Pew, pew! The game bar.
Yeah.
Metapew.
So, final thoughts and your rating. Guest Natalie, would you like to go first?
Sure. I thought it was a fine book. I'll probably try to read one of her other works.
Which are all well-reviewed bestsellers.
Yeah. Pew, 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 pew.
Three pews.
Whew. Well, that's a six in my mind. So it's like a little bit better than half.
I think our overall rating for the sci-fi classic Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep was like a pew.
1.5.
Three pews. Pew, pew, pew.
It was 1.5.
Pretty high. Pew noises.
Twice as very good high. As Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep.
Phil K. Dick. Zach?
Mine, I would be, it would be, well, yeah, 50 Shades of Terraforming. My review is pew, 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 pew. I've said this a thousand times already, but yeah, I really enjoyed the first part, but once Destry is killed off, it's hard for me to rebuild interest. Like you were saying, it's kind of kills the momentum. Especially because I also then assumed something like that was going to happen for the next part. So I was like anticipating not really getting attached. And so that was my biggest complaint. And a lot of the sex stuff was a little too much.
Cool.
So yeah, two.
Pew, 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 pew.
Four noises.
Four
mouth noises. Yeah. I'll go next and then Britt can bring it home positively. I'm going to give it a single pew. Pew.
Not
even a whole pew. Just so for me.
And you gave Dick's book two pew-pews.
Yeah. For me, this read like a young adult novel. And if I'm going to read a YA novel, I'd read Ender's Game 1,000 times over before I would read this again. Ender's Game does not have the weird sex. Like, it felt...
Or the giver.
The characters and the characters were YA characters. Like, every single person in this book was a YA character. The naked mole rats who wear sweaters, the worm people, talking trains, they're all YA characters. The droids, the bots that you ride, the snarkiness of them, 100% a YA book. And then when you add the weird sex stuff, I'm like, I don't want this person around my children, let alone will I allow my children to read this book. I really like, do not get my children this book. I really like the environmental stewardship message of the book. I like the inclusive writing of the book, except when it becomes so clunky. But between the poor execution of the writing and the overall weird mismatch and the painfulness of the drama, there are ways to make ecological disaster and terraforming a drama. The weird characterization of the characters juxtaposed with the weird sex stuff totally removes any hope of me buying into that drama. So I'm going to stick with a single pew.
Wow.
And from the lowest review, we have the highest.
10 pew pew.
I give it's a scale of 1 to 5. I give The Terraformers by Annalee Newitz 4 pew pews. Pew pew, pew pew, pew pew, pew pew. And I wonder if it is not just my reading and great enjoyment of this book, but also what I read. Because I was talking earlier about, you know, the canon that you come to a book with influences the way you read it. I don't know if this is too much information in a professional setting, but I have read many a spicy sci-fi fantasy book. I read a lot of YA. So I was, you know, engaged by the characters in a way that simultaneously had a low bar. You know, I could just kind of put that hat on and go with the flow because I do read a lot of those books. I read a lot of, you know, higher fantasy, which you tend to go more towards like intellectual sci-fi. So I can see why this is not your jam.
Not my cup of petal juice.
Ew, not petal juice.
What do they drink?
I don't know.
They talk about a lot of what they eat, but they don't really talk about what they drink.
Hydrogen monoxide. But yeah, so I think I came to this obviously with a lot of my own literary experience and background, and I feel like Annalee is right on target with her target demographic. the people reading books right now, the people reviewing
15 to 24.
So yeah, right now, some of the biggest influencers that are keeping books in print right now are people reviewing books on TikTok, and people like looking at book recommendations on Instagram, and their target demographic is not you.
Correct.
So I think that this is, you know, a book written in 2023. Mm-hmm. I think it's written for an audience that is not necessarily everyone that's in this room. But I very much enjoyed it.
I will say,
yeah,
this book will probably be banned in at least 25 states. So get it while you can.
Good pitch. Annalee will be sending you a check in the mail. all right. Any last words? No. So our next book then will be The Peripheral by William Gibson, also the author of Neuromancer, the guy who created much of the vocabulary around where we are right now in the 21st century, cyberpunk, virtual reality, all of those terminologies came from William Gibson. So Peripheral, also an Amazon series that is excellent. So I would recommend that to anybody. And that is what we'll dive into next. And I read it recently.
Good student.
Take it away with our catchphrase.
What's our catchphrase?
I don't know.
Oh, shit. Did we have a catchphrase last time?
You're going to come
get
up
your
with
pedals out of here.
Yeah. Take your pedals and go.
Put your stamen
you
away.
You stinking pile of... In the basement where the nerds reside, we gather round with a wicked stride, with our books in hand, we start to die into dystopian worlds that come alive.